I've listened, obviously, with the anniversaries related to Darwin. I've attended numerous lectures in various universities in the area here, and all of these conversations and comments are wonderful. I've lived a wonderful life. I'm happy. I have children, grandchildren. I look forward to my great-great-grandchildren, if that's feasible. But I want to read a comment as I was listening to your comments, and I kind of took my own notes. And the bottom line is I'm troubled. The world is fraught with complexity and differences, and humanity, in the shape of billions of individuals, is trying to find comfort amid this complexity and extreme uncertainty. Each individual, within their own limits of knowledge and sensibility, will strive to establish a solid footing in life, which is based on fact or faith. Fact as presented by science or the media, and faith as presented by religion or the media. I think the world lacks a philosophical conversation that can reach the common man and leadership that can inspire the survival of the common man. I think there's a simplicity behind the conversation that's going on, and the statements and the knowledge and the perceptions are complex in themselves. So where is the simplicity? Is my thoughts.
Okay. Not here.
Let's let that stand. Or can you just say something? Yes.
If the implication of the question is that we are in an ivory tower when we are talking these things, while millions of people are not quite familiar with the sorts of things we are talking about, if I believe that's what the question was, I think the comment is absolutely right. And that is why I feel that any amount of demonstration of religious truths through quantum mechanics and Big Bang theory are really of no interest to the truly faithful, whose faith and practice have nothing to do with proofs and quotations from Hawkins or whoever.
I would modify his statement by saying I think there's a person missing from this extraordinary panel, and that's the politician, because I think in and of themselves there is no conflict between science and religion unless it is politically contrived. A person who is brought up away from religion and not subjected to the carrot and stick of most organized religions would not find a problem between the moral purview of religions and the intellectual purview of science. But I do find, especially in today's society, that, for instance, it is almost impossible to take the issue of evolution away from the rallying point of the neocons, along with abortion and gay marriage, for instance. And it's very hard to pry open the minds of someone who's been brought up to believe that it's immoral to believe in evolution. And until you make it a non-political issue, science and religion will always butt heads. And I wish that there were a politician who would address this question, but I'm sure one of you has, or all of you have something to say about that.
May I say something in response to that? Yeah. You brought up the issue of politicians being missing. This summer, I was listening, as I often do, to National Public Radio, and I was working around my farm, and they had an interview with Senator Rick Santorum on TV, and Senator Santorum had just published a book called It Takes a Family. Wonder where he got that idea for a title. It was a puff piece. He was basically being allowed to promote his book, and it was a nice conversation with the host. And he expounded on his ideas. And towards the end of the conversation, the host said, Senator Santorum, one of the things I was surprised about is that you, a United States senator, with no special training in science, in the middle of your book, you take a shot at part of the science curriculum. And that, of course, is evolution. What is there about evolution that bothers you so much? And I think I can almost remember exactly what Senator Santorum said. I can certainly paraphrase it. And he says, well, it's tremendously important. Everything depends on it, because it concerns where we come from. And then he expounded, he said, if we're just a mistake, if you and I are just an accident of nature, that places a different moral demand on us. And then he thought for a second. He said, in fact, it doesn't place any moral demands on us than if we are the intentional creation of a supreme being that does have moral demands. And I thought about that and I said, boy, he really put that well. Because in essence, and I say that not because I agree with it, but he put that very well because in essence, he put his finger on the notion that if we see our origins as a species in natural processes, to Senator Santorum, that means the whole idea of morality is an illusion. And people like him have built their entire lives, I take him as sincere, his political career on a certain sense of morality. And I think morality in politics is a really good thing. Because morality just isn't about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Morality is also about a just foreign policy, justice for the poor, how a society should be structured. And I think we need more moral questions in the public sphere. But the interesting thing is when you see someone say, morality itself, the very concept of right and wrong, is an illusion if our species has a natural origin. I almost wanted to, you know, drive out to Pennsylvania, drive out to Washington and say, Rick, let's have lunch. Let me talk to you about this. Because the whole notion that morality has to be connected by a sort of puff, has to be driven by a puff of smoke creation and a set of intentional and arbitrary commands from a supreme being is, I think, one of the most vacuous ideas that one could possibly have. And I think ultimately, as a weapon in the culture wars, it's extremely dangerous. So I completely agree with you.
One more tiny thing that maybe you could use in future is that I think the best argument against creationism is that God would have to be not particularly bright, just as a phrasing.
Then there's someone like Sherwin Nuland, a physician at Yale, who has come to the conclusion that morality and human consciousness is in fact a product of the evolution of the brain. I mean, there are other ways to think about morality.
You want to talk about that for 60 seconds?
60 seconds.
Okay, here you go.
Okay.
I think we know, as well as we know anything else in science, that an evolutionary process produced our bodies. And if one can see such a process as being within the providential plan of a creator, it doesn't basically disqualify religion, the moral sense, the sense of right and wrong, to say that the very same evolutionary process produced our capacity to experience the Almighty or our sense of right and wrong. So if the notion is that the same evolutionary process that produced our bodies also produced our moral sense, and therefore you're going to disqualify morality as a result, you might as well disqualify science, because that evolutionary process also produced our ability to embrace scientific rationalism.
Right, to ask the questions we do. Yes?
I want my minute.
Okay.
Ken's answer would be the case for robots as well as people. But we're not robots. We are born helpless, and we die helpless. And we are totally dependent on social structures from before birth throughout our lives to become human beings. There's no more pathological disaster than a child raised without parental interaction. He can or she cannot form a mind without mirroring the appearance of that child in the mind of an adult who raises that child. So the mental world is a social world. And we know that it is not encoded to be a particular social world. What is encoded is families caring. There are 3 billion letters in the text of human DNA, 2 copies each. There are at least 1 million times more connections among the neurons in a brain than there are letters in the DNA. There cannot be an encoding of a thought. There cannot be an encoding of a mental process, only the encoded capacity to gain a mental life through social interaction. The second path of change, the second path of emergent novelty, if you listen to Dawkins, the second path for natural selection is in the mind, in which ideas compete for each other for survival by teaching and learning. Now, that may be just a way to bring meaninglessness back into the mental sphere, but there is no possibility that the mental world is encoded in one's DNA. Therefore, there is no possibility of it being available for natural selection of the Darwinian sort. It is a byproduct, possibly a lethal one, certainly a glorious one, certainly a unique one that we know of. But it is not the same as the body. There is no mind-body separation in terms of a non-physical spirit that one can assay for, but there is certainly a difference in mental states. Mental states are learned states, taught states, social states. They're not robotic states.
Okay. I'm a Louisiana-bred Creole Catholic, and I say that to say that although we were raised with all the traditional Catholic things, we also were infused with the metaphysics and the paranormal of life. Just quickly, my grandfather was renowned for people bringing the blood of their animals to him to cure, and allegedly as folklore goes, he does. And I have been given somewhat of that gift. So I came here tonight to hear what scientists think about miracles or the paranormal or the metaphysics of life.
Yes, there are two ways of looking at miracles, it seems to me. One, simply as a violation of a natural law. That kind of miracle, as far as I know, science does not accept, because there does not seem to be any overwhelming evidence for such occurrences. On the other hand, if by miracle one means something that is extraordinarily wonderful in the normal course of things, then upon reflection one would find that the very existence of precisely defined, mathematically precise laws which govern this whole universe for eons on end is a miracle in itself, and that is the kind of miracle that most scientists would willingly grant.
Hmm. Would you like to say anything about miracle and mystery?
Well, sure, I'm happy to say something about it. I think very often when one hears a question like that, one hears what scientists say about miracles, that very often people are expecting, well, I'm going to give you a biological explanation of the resurrection, or I'm going to explain to you how you can change water into wine, or something like that. I'd be working on that one, too, if I was pretty sure that was something that could be
done. I don't think that's what she was asking about.
So far, no success. But to me, in a way, the miraculous is... a scientist either takes the miraculous as existence itself, which is to say that every moment of existence is itself a miracle, and our lives are a miracle, and our presence in this auditorium this evening is a miracle. Or, if one talks about specific acts which are central to the great religions of the world, very often I think a scientist has to be agnostic on those miracles. Not agnostic, but agnostic on the miracles themselves. I can't possibly tell you whether the Red Sea parted miraculously, and I cannot tell you whether a burning bush spoke to Moses. I accept the message that is in those scriptures of God's interactions with man. But again, on the whole issue of the miraculous, I think most people, and from the scientific point of view, have to say, we can't be sure. Mm-hmm.
That's an issue that I believe is one of the central ones dividing conservatives and liberals in Christianity. And it's so much neater to say that what appears to be a miracle, if we only understood the science well enough, we would see that it was an unusual event, but one not outside of the order of nature. But I've decided that if you go down that line, you have to give up too much of the devotion, the practices, the historicity of the main religions. And so that's what puts me on the conservative side of that line. I'm not willing to make the liberal theological move and say that God's action is restricted to maintaining and upholding the cosmic order. I think God has to do a lot more in order to be a meaningful object of worship and prayer and interaction.
Can I say one thing? Mm-hmm. It has always seemed strange to me that when someone breaks a law that is made by man, a statutory law, we call him a felon or a criminal. But when someone breaks a law of God, he is said to perform a miracle.
I see this question as a personal one. And I do say a prayer in which I thank the Creator for fashioning me in such a way that the openings stay open and the closed parts of my body stay closed so that I may stand and say thank you. And I believe, in fact, that I'm very close to the notion that every minute one is alive is miraculous. And I'll say that quantitatively as a biologist to say that the negative entropy of a living thing is extraordinarily unnatural and rare and exists no place else but where life exists. And the tendency of all other parts of the natural world is to run down to chaos and to dilute to meaninglessness. The ability of life over 5 billion years to create structures that are complex at every level is, if not miraculous, of such low probability that I can't see the difference.
Yes.
Hello, I'm listening tonight. It comes to my mind that our conversation has focused exclusively on the conflict between religion and science. And I wonder whether that conflict could be resolved at this point in history without revisiting the historical deep conflicts between different religions and philosophies that led to all kinds of destructive wars, and whether the only way that we could really address the conflict between religion and science is through a deeper focus on metaphysical questions in our educational system, philosophical questions. Everyone on this panel today has, in some form or another, visited the question of science and faith by referring to normative questions of some sort. And although students, as quoted by Professor Nurfi, may in some classes have a 90% rate of belief in a conflict between religion and science, is that mainly due to the fact that we're not educating our students enough in philosophical questions and in metaphysical inquiry so that they can understand that science has its limits and that there are questions which are not addressed by science but have to be addressed by another form of inquiry, mm-hmm. which does entail some serious thinking and requires some training mm-hmm. in order to obtain knowledge in those domains? I just appreciate any thoughts you guys have on those questions.
Certainly, a large part of the problem is that these conflicts emerge in settings where sometimes people have only high school educations or only bachelor's level educations, and they're really complex questions. So it takes a lot of philosophizing, etc., to come to solutions. And it's so here we are in our little ivory tower group here, talking in terms that probably most of my family members back on the ranch wouldn't understand. So there's a kind of cultural gap, and it's also a gap in intellectual resources to use to address the conflicts in a way that will reduce them rather than reduce the conflict without reducing the rhetoric to polarized slogans.
Yes, the greatest loss of life in the 20th century, I believe I could document, took place at the hands of avowedly secular states like China, Russia, and the Nazi German government. This is not to justify religious violence. It's simply to say that the will to do evil emerges in people regardless of almost anything but the will to not do evil, and that there is no proof against it by religion, through religious observance. It's individual work all the time to do better.
Yes.
My name is Gideon Beer. I'm a member of New York City Atheists. This is to Dr. Pollack. I believe you said that natural design is without purpose. It seems to me that there is a very clear purpose, and that purpose is to survive by adapting to the environment. In other words, by evolving. In other words, the purpose of life is evolution. And to Dr. Rahman, I would like to say, you talk of the wonders of religion. I think we also have to think of some of the things that religion has caused. The Holocaust was a direct result of Christian persecution of the Jews. It was a direct outgrowth of that. Religion leads people to fly airplanes into buildings, to blow up mosques. What happened when the English left the subcontinent? The Muslims and the Hindus started slaughtering each other. Even in Japan, several centuries ago, we had Buddhists killing each other. This is not in spite of religion. This is because of religion. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Let's take another question or comment.
Say again?
I want to keep moving and have a couple more comments and questions, and then we'll come back and finish the discussion. Thank you.
I think the gentleman is concerned that his question is not being addressed, but actually Dr. Pollack has already addressed it, and he's pointed out that the great mass slaughters of the 20th century were all secular in nature, and there is no question that religion is often used as a guide for the most vicious forms of human cruelty, but so has state socialism been, utopianism, and a whole variety of other ideologies. Religion is just one of many powerful ideas behind which people will cloak their own propensity to do the most terrible things to each other.
Good. Having heard my colleague say that, I will add only that there is, in this country today, a dominant ideology based on bad science or non-science, which causes more suffering than any religious dispute, and that is racism. The bad biology that implies people of different continents of origin are of different value is a leftover of our history of slavery. It is a disaster which, as a biologist, I'm embarrassed to say remains a part of our civilization and culture, and it occupies people of every religion. Those of you who, like me, have friends of many religions will know it is the social disease of this country.
Yes, I am a biologist at the museum. My upbringing is Catholic. I'm Catholic, but I am among the unlucky scientists. I can say that lost their faith when I started reading about evolution. And
no, I can't.
Well, I lost my faith.
You lost your faith?
Yes, through science. And I don't regret. But, well, my question is to Dr. Pollack and Dr. Miller. And unless you have inside you the concept that God is a construct of human mind, I don't understand how you, Dr. Miller, says that we need God to discern between ignorance and knowledge. And I don't understand also how Dr. Pollack, in his last sentence, a quote of his presentation, he said that we need to teach a way, a mean, to learn how not to deny a painful truth that is that we need to accept evolution. Why don't we accept that also for God? That we need to accept that God doesn't exist. How can we teach something? I know that I'm wrong. I mean, that's not possible. But I sometimes feel like intellectuals actually are kind of denying and just trying to, you know.
I'm having trouble hearing, but did the two of you?
Well, I had trouble hearing as well, but let me try to guess what you, seriously, I just couldn't hear the words. Mm-hmm. Let me guess what you started out with. Did you say that science caused you to lose your faith? Yes,
well,
no?
Yes.
Okay, good. And then you went on with that. And then basically you said you wanted to hear from the two scientists go ahead.
And I think that you are schizophrenic because you, I think that, how can you believe in God and at the same time accept science? At the same time, I know that, I can understand it and I can accept it. I think that we don't need God to discern between knowledge and ignorance, as you said at some point. And I think that we need to... So I think that's my point.
Well, if the question is how does one believe in God at the same time as one believes in science, the question itself has the implication that somehow these are opposites, and how can you believe in them? And I think the simple answer is I find these two ways of knowing and understanding to be complementary and not contradictory. I certainly see nothing in science that contradicts the idea of meaning and purpose and a supreme being behind everything that we see in nature. And for myself personally, and I think religion is always a personal matter, not personal in the sense you don't want to talk about it, but personal in the sense that we all struggle to make sense of our lives and to make sense of our existence. And for myself, the hypothesis of God orders my life. It gives a meaning to the scientific work that I do. It explains the moral sense that I feel that evil and good are genuine things. And the hypothesis of God, to me, completes that vision in a way that makes perfect sense.
So it's a hypothesis.
Okay.
It's not faith. It's a hypothesis.
Wait, you heard my words, so you don't have to repeat them. Yes, I said it. Yes. When I say the hypothesis of God, what I'm talking about
is the idea. So it's a construct of your mind.
Okay.
Could I try, Krista?
Yes, right? And I'd also like to hear Vivi Raman respond to this.
I will tell a story of a conversation I had with my teacher, Adin Steinsaltz, who writes and translates many books. I was confronted by a colleague in Colombia whose reading of my work led him to say to me, "You should stop wasting your time with ritual. We both come to the same decision as to what is good and bad behavior. I don't put myself at risk of making the mistake of following a ritual that might dissuade me or deflect me from good behavior, and you do take that risk. Why don't you just stop the nonsense?" And I asked Rabbi Steinsaltz, "What may I say to him that makes sense to you?" And he said, "Look, if you ever find a friend who says the throne of God is empty and means it and lives that way, hold on to that friend because that friend is stronger than you. But first make sure that that person does not place himself on the throne of God."
One theme that's come out in the conversation, which I'm very aware of and familiar with, is this idea of fear that the Christians will have, or people of faith will have, that if their children are taught Darwinism, that it will be taught in the as if it were an end in itself, as if that were all it is, and that is a very common thing that happens in the classroom. That you teach Darwin and nothing else. I'm a Christian who teaches Darwin, and I always tell my students, and if you think Darwin is all there is, of course, your only purpose in life is to reproduce, so just keep that in mind. But which is, you know, good for teenagers.
These students are adolescents?
Yes.
And you're giving them this...
So it's this philosophical Darwinism and the behavioral Darwinism, as you've talked about in terms of moral issues, which has people freaked out in the Christian community because they're afraid their children will believe there's nothing more. But there's also fear on the other side, which we've become aware of in another panel we went to recently, my husband and I, which is that the people who are sort of don't believe in religion and take science as all there is that people won't believe science and therefore will not respond to the very important discoveries of science, for example, global warming and so on. Mm. So they're terrified, too, that we're going to raise a whole society of ignorant voters who are going to ignore what we're doing to the environment. They're going to ignore the pollution we're creating in the air because they're going to be suspicious of science in general, and we're going to destroy, as Jared Diamond suggests, destroy our environment and collapse, you know, like societies before us. So one issue is, how do we make sure that as we teach in the classroom Darwinism, but we're not allowed to teach religion, how do we make sure everybody understands that, and how does a textbook make sure that everybody understands that this is not all there is? And my second question is, I have conversations with some fairly big, important preachers in the evangelical Christian community, and they always get hung up on one thing when I try to tell them about evolution, and that is the image of God, because they feel like somehow the image of God must be attached to anatomy. And my claim is that it can't have anything to do with anatomy because your body dies and it disintegrates. But they said that theologically, the body and the soul are one. They cannot, they're intertwined, so there must be something. So do you have an idea of what Imago Dei really is? And do you have an idea of how we can stop the presumption that Darwinism is all there is, that is communicated, however unintentionally, in the classroom?
In response to the issue about Imago Dei, biblical scholars recognize it as one of the most highly contested passages in Scripture, and so you can always come back and say the scholars haven't figured it out yet. But the two leading theories are one that it has to do with being created male and female, and thus in relationship, and the other is that it has to do with having been given dominion over the rest of the living organisms.
This is in Genesis, I just want to clarify.
So it doesn't have anything to do with having a soul, and it doesn't have anything to do with the form of the human body. It has to do with playing a godlike role in the rest of creation.
I'd like to address the first question, that is, how does one teach on the matter of, is that all there is? I think what one can always say when all else fails is the truth. That is, that that is all there is by science. Mm-hmm. And that when one teaches science, one has to restrict oneself to demonstrable, disprovable, experimentally demonstrable notions and not go over that line. I face this every year when I teach at Columbia University. I will have a student say to me, I'll do what you want, I have the book, I'll do what I have to, but I know the Bible is true. I know things were all created at once. I know the universe is 5,756 years old. And I used to argue, but I don't argue with students anymore because I think it's a mistake. We're not speaking the same language. So what I try to do is teach. And the way I've come to teach is to say, look, if someone says, if I say to you that I'm going to teach that the world was created 20 minutes ago, complete with memories, I'm done. But I can't do that because it's not demonstrable. It's not disprovable in particular. And so the entirety of interesting and uninteresting ideas which are not disprovable are not available for teaching in a science context. I think that's a sufficient answer, and one does not have to either ask, know, or reveal one's own religious intentions in that answer.
I think the question is, how do you make room? How do you make space?
Respectfully.
For people to have those other kinds of questions.
Well, I think another thing is, the questioner asked about Darwinism. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I know what Darwinism is. The very word ism implies a kind of ideology, a kind of philosophy. And I think certainly, as a biologist and somebody who's been involved in science education for a very long time, both as a teacher and as a provider of course material for people in K through 12 to teach science, I think the right way to teach evolution is to teach it for what it is, which is a theory of biological origins, strongly supported by the facts, not as a philosophy, not as an all-encompassing value system. And if you understand that what we're talking about is the biological origin of our species, then it becomes limited, as all scientific ideas have to be limited, to the question at hand. And does it leave room for other things? Of course it does, because science properly understood is always confined in that respect.
Sure. I agree.
You can make a couple. Mm-hmm. Just a couple of comments about a question that science removed the person's faith. I think if science did it, then that faith was not worth entertaining. Because faith in a deeper sense is not usually perturbed by what science says or does not. And many of the disadvantages or difficulties that have happened to religion or to religious people is that science has revealed that some of the traditional concepts and images and views on God are no longer tenable, which is different from saying that a deeper understanding and appreciation of the mystery behind it all has been erased. And I personally would emphasize once again, and here I may differ from the other views, that religion is to a large extent a personal experience, and it is not necessarily divisive, different from from science, in that we have many other experiences, the experience of music, the experience of humor, the experience of sports. We do not have conflicts between these other experiences and science. The only reason we have with religion is that the experience includes what science superbly does, and that is the explanation of natural phenomena. And it is that approach to religion which, in my view, and to me personally, makes religion an enormously enriching personal fulfillment as against the particular doctrines which may be broken, which may be shattered by scientific and rational analysis.
I'm going to take, this is the last question. Sorry.
And then. Perhaps we might be able to smush the questions all together. Mine is trying to inject a bit of a, well, to breach perhaps a taboo social convention or social taboo by talking about sex and the role particularly of sexual selection in evolution, which is...
So we're talking about sex and religion.
Sex and religion, and also the history of sexuality in religion, in particular its role. I'm thinking of a book I just read by Jeffrey Miller called The Mating Mind, which explores the role of sexual selection in creating many of the, or in enhancing perhaps many of the features that are uniquely human to us, you know, our propensity for music, for poetry, things that don't necessarily have an easily explainable adaptive function in evolutionary history.
What's your question?
So my question then is, if the panelists might be willing to comment upon, a lot has been talked about biological death and the, how would I say it, just the inevitability, obviously, and also how that inspires us to consider what is passing beyond, and then, of course, the necessity for sex as a means to propagate ourselves. So it's kind of an open-ended question for biologists to comment about, scientists as well as religious scholars to comment about sexuality and sex, as well as death, is performing a vital function in our lives as something that is perhaps even at the essence of our humanity.
I just don't know if we can end this conversation about science and religion on sex. I'm not sure if that's acceptable. If anyone wants to pick that up.
Well, we could instead of ending it on sex, we could always end it on death. George Wald, Nobel Prize winner for discovering the chemistry of vision, used to teach introductory biology at Harvard. And every year he gave a lecture called Sex and Death. And it drew about three times the enrollment of the class to hear it. And George's point, and this might be interpretable for the Garden of Eden or something along those lines, George's point was death comes about because of sex. If you have an asexually reproducing organism, a bacterium that just divides, there is no distinction between parent and offspring. There's no such thing as a generation. Because an organism divides, and whose parent, whose offspring, you don't know. It keeps dividing, it keeps growing. Individuals die. But in terms of continuity, the organism that might be alive a billion years from now has been produced by a series of divisions in which equal cells were always produced. As far as you know, it is the original organism. So therefore, if you reproduce asexually, you are immortal. It's only sexual reproduction, which involves genetic recombination and a distinction between parent and offspring, that brings about the inevitability of personal and individual death. So in a way, and as I say, this might be a Garden of Eden moment, death is the price we pay for sex. And
good place to end.
And opinion is divided, I think most of us would say it's worth it.
may I add one?
Yes.
In the Hindu mystical tradition, it is stated that the divine ecstasy that one feels with the communion with God, we get an inkling of that in the sexual experience. So the Hindu mystical tantric tradition combines sex or illustrates sex as a taste of what divine bliss is all about.
Science and religion, then, is what we're talking about, that it touches, they embrace, so to speak, on the subject of sex. So I just thought that was...
Right. And I think that brings us at the end to mystery. And I actually thought we should give the last word to Charles Darwin. This is the final from the final paragraph of The Origin of Species, which I think, Kenneth Miller, you also used to end your book, Darwin's God. It is interesting to contemplate an entangled bank clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent on each other in so complex a manner, have all been produced by laws acting around us. He continues a little later, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers, having been originally breathed into a few forms or into one, and that whilst this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed laws of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. So, thank you all for coming. And thank you.